Welcome back to the podcast. My name is Anthony Montaghi, and today we are going to talk about what it takes to start up an organization. You know, we've got an entrepreneur who has really specialized in taking major organizations from 10 to thousands and all the stages that a startup company will go through. Roland brings to the team and brings to the podcast some really great insight, and I'm excited about having him on there. Roland, he's got three great books out there. We're going to talk about them as well. It's exciting to have you on the show. Roland, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anthony. It's an honor to be here. So excited.
You know, as we go through it, you know, growing organizations is the thing I love talking about the most, right? We talk about how to grow them, and the entrepreneur goes through a lot when they do that. And I want to jump right into, you know, you've grown some major Silicon Valley companies. Talk about how, you know, what's the secret? Let's get started on what does it mean to make those huge growth models?
Yeah, so I think the secret is that it's not just sticking with one mode all the way from early stage startup and then expecting that to turn into a major corporation at one go. I think the secret is being able to reinvent yourself and constantly focus on what does my startup, what does my company need from me as a leader at this very stage. And what is so difficult about it is that what it needs in the next stage is very often very different from what it needed in the previous stage. And that happens four or five, six times in a row. So there's a need for constant reinvention of you as a leader, but also as the culture that you set, the priorities that you set. And very often the feedback we get from founders is a year in, they're like, I don't even recognize my company anymore. But that's a good thing, because now I realize we were stuck in a mode that wasn't helping us.
I mean, look, who you are to start the company, it certainly changes. I mean, let's talk a little bit about the mindset of a startup entrepreneur, because a lot of that startup stuff isn't for the faint of heart, right? There's a lot of it that's literally like an arm wrestling down of an idea, right? And that mode is different than, you know, what most people are used to. I mean, you know, those first startup days, you're making something out of nothing.
Absolutely. And, you know, a colleague in this field, Rachel Turner, calls this the brave warrior mode, right? Where you're really like the only one believing in the idea. You're trying to get a few band members on, and your real criterion for saying should I hire them or not is just like, do they also believe me? And do they kind of enable me to make this idea come to work? So that is all great at an early stage. And you really need to be in that brave warrior mode, where you have a lot of control over exactly what you're trying to build for your customers. You incorporate feedback very quickly. You don't have time for long discussions with your teams. But anyway, everyone's around the breakfast table, or, you know, whatever the virtual equivalent is these days. So they all know each other. There's a lot of trust. So you can move really fast. But that same mode of trying to take all the decisions, changing everything at a whim, will work very great, very well when you're less than 10 people. But what if you're 50 or 100 people? Then suddenly this means everyone's just waiting for you to make up your mind, or they're taking action and then they already know you're going to change your mind tomorrow. So what's the point of really making a solid plan? What I've seen time and time again, Anthony, is when companies are in like the 100, 150 employees, you know, ballpark, and the CEO founders have not changed their mindset. Essentially, you have 100, 110, 150 people just sitting there and waiting for the founder to give them an assignment. And once they do, they jump really fast. They're almost completely optimized for doing whatever the founder asked them to do, but just for one day. And then they just drop it again because they already know the founder's already forgotten about it.
Let's go back. So in those early stages, as a founder, you have to take the bull by the horns. I mean, the people that work for you, they don't see it at all. I mean, essentially you're the one taking an idea and you have to kind of force it over to them. I mean, let's talk about that mindset. So I don't know that a lot of people, you know, when you're in a startup mode, it's difficult to create a committee type of leadership, right?
Especially, it wouldn't work.
It doesn't work, right? I mean, you have to, there's too many ideas. Someone has to make a choice.
And it's so confusing in that early stage that, and you have so little data that really it's an intuitive choice you have to make. So it's your gut feel as a founder. So really, I like to compare that early stage model as almost like a rock star and a few assistants or enablers. And that's also typically the kind of people that founders hire as their first 10 co-founders. It's the kind of people they have a lot of trust in that can assist them with whatever they ask, right? So just like Lady Gaga has an entourage of like all kinds of enablers, this is typically the kind of model that an early stage startup works best at. So I'm not actually dissing this. I'm saying this is a great model, right?
Look, that's what I want to get at. Look, you entrepreneurs are feeling like, hey, am I being too bossy? Am I pushing this too hard? No. Look.
At that stage,
you have to do it. Look, yes. don't the idea, you have to trust your intuition. And the more work you do on yourself, trust that intuition, get the ideas, move with the flow, keep it moving. You know, trust that those people are looking, those startup people that are in that phase are looking for you to do that. You hesitate, they hesitate, right? You got to be the one that boldly pushes people forward in that space. And, you know, my judgment is you're exactly right. You're bringing on the entourage that believes in that. Now, those people don't operate. We'll talk about the next couple of iterations. Mm-hmm. But those people operate. They're looking for that. They're thirsty for that. And when you don't show up doing that, it actually ruins the energy, right? The momentum stops. They're all kind of, they all, you know, lose focus. You give them focus and creating that. So, you know, am I right there?
Absolutely. And, you know, also looking at like, who are the people that you hire typically in that stage? So, you know, taking the typical first time founder as somebody right out of college, or maybe still even in college, you know, the people that they hire as the first to come on board, it's not that they have that much choices. You cannot typically persuade somebody experienced to join a startup at that stage. So who do they hire? Their college buddies, right? So there's a lot of trust there, but little experience. So you cannot actually, you know, have two big discussions around you. Well, what would you do? Because essentially they're all just buying into your idea and they're telling you, tell me what to do and I'll do it.
And it's natural. Look, my first companies, I would hire people that were, my project management company, my first employees were like bar managers. They were buddies of mine, right? And I'd bring them in, and they were, and I'd like tape them to a stick, and I would shake the stick and pretend like they were doing something, you know. And it was literally just, you know, I needed some people. I didn't have the whole company figured out yet, but those people were the people that wanted to do something different and brought them in, and boldly we went and did some amazing stuff. Like that group of people didn't know you couldn't do something. Right.
Exactly. Yes. Very good point you make there, Anthony. Yeah, I think experience is actually harmful at that stage, right? Because you need the kind of people that just have a lot of energy and who are in a way naive or unaware that certain things have already been tried many times before. That you just want the kind of people who follow you through the fire no matter what.
A little bit of young and dumb. And you can also be old and dumb. I mean, but a little bit of naivety. Yes. Isn't so bad for that space in there, and find those people that will go with you and fight through that. You know, look, that's so look, if you entrepreneurs are going through that right now and you look at the people that are working for you and they're not perfect and you're like, I wish I had that guy. Look, maybe you can't afford them or maybe you're not there yet, but if you can lead them from a, you know, sense of bringing clarity to conversation and guide them down a path that guides them to through a fire, they'll go with you. They'll go with you and they'll have your back the whole time. And at the end of it, they'll look back and go, that was fun, right? The first time that, you know, we were in this basement office and I had an old, like it was an old wooden dining room table that was down in the basement and it had four chairs on it. And I sat at one end, you know, an assistant sat in the middle and the other guy sat on the other end. And then one guy didn't want to sit at the table. So he sat on a garbage can. Yeah, exactly. he looked like the guy from the Peanuts, the little piano player. Yeah. He looked like that guy. He was a really big guy. He sat on a sort of garbage can. And, you know, the first big program we ever got was from a company called Darden Restaurants, who owns Red Lobster.
Yeah.
And they gave us this massive remodel project that we literally had, you know, we were not capable of doing it, but we got it somehow out of a wish and a prayer. We just worked really hard on making, you know, trying to get sales and telling our story and really talking about our passion, how much we love the business. And we got it not because we deserved it. We got it because we were passionate.
Absolutely. And
the people that we were working for, they liked our passion, right? They, you know, we were willing to go take on working in these old restaurants, and we had no fear. We went and did it. And that was the gift then. I don't know that today, when we take on projects, we ask a lot more questions. We need a lot, today, the size companies that it is, you can't do that, right? We have to, we spend a lot of time lining these up before we take them. And sometimes I miss that ready, shoot, aim mentality a little bit,
Absolutely. And I think, Anthony, I can just say that this is so common, taking a bit of a jump now into like when a company is 100, 150, 200 people, where the founders really say, why can't we get stuff done as fast as we used to? And we have 70 engineers now and they don't get anything done as fast as when we had two. Why is that, right? And, I think you pointed out the answer already. It's because you learn a lot more about your business. You learn a lot about, like, what are all the things that we, we made errors on, where we had, things that fell through the cracks. So you start building checklists, you start building, all kinds of processes. And I think the passion of the founder is really to build a company that does not turn into a big bureaucracy, right? So this is where we have found like some middle way. It's actually why I called in the end the company the Mid-Stage Institute, because I think the way that an early stage startup operates is often contrasted directly to how a corporation operates. But there's no easy transition from one into the other. There's actually this whole mid-stage where it's like learning to be a little bit more robust while still keeping that zeal of that startup alive, still attracting highly qualified people, but people that were flexible and able to learn a lot rather than somebody who neatly fits into a box because they've done that all their lives, right? And also I would say the 20-80 rule, where you particularly focus on getting 80% of the result with just 20% of the effort, not trying to make everything idiot-proof like a big corporation would do and trying to solve all the hundreds of edge cases before you even put it to the field, right? So there's a huge difference there.
Yeah, you know what happens with those early guys, you're just doing.
Yeah.
Right? There's no process. Let's just do. And, with that comes some brain damage. I mean, it does come with a little bit of brain damage. You mess some stuff up. But as you get more mature, you're trying to create these processes, and it's good. But I've now transitioned to the next phase. Like I've mm-hmm. created all those processes, right? I've got there, and then I watched the organization get very sluggish.
Yeah,
and I also noticed that some of that stuff is made up. We make mm-hmm. up these processes that aren't real. They're too thought out. By the way, no manual I've ever written, every freaking operations manual, and every time someone comes in, we have to have a standard operating procedure, and there's got to be a book, and we got to do this. And as soon as it's written, it's useless.
Yes. And this is a perfect example, Anthony, of corporate thinking not being applicable in that mid-stage, right?
Yeah.
So what I will say is, of course, you need some kind of a guideline of how to do things when you want to scale that, because you cannot just have everyone reinvent the wheel, which is what an early stage startup would do. But in the mid stage, you need, I think, less of a process and more of a checklist. That's always my advice, where, try to only highlight what are the 7 to 10 steps to take in order to do this right. So give people the guidance, like what does a good job look like? Do not, like in typical processes, try to solve for all the edge cases, all the exceptions and all that stuff. And especially do not hire process consultants that write documents who are different people than the people who actually execute it. I think the key is also, you can give them like a high level checklist, but then the key is now hand it over to the actual teams that are working on it and tell them, this is your own, this is your manual. You add like the exact how to, like what does every checkbox mean? Where are some references for that? And have your employees do that. I'd even go one step further, Anthony. I think this is often a great job for a new hire to basically document everything they learn from their peers and turn it into that, that checklist or that documentation on the intranet or whatever they may have, because it's the new pair of eyes that is actually the smartest at writing down what is the headline here versus all the experience that people may add that may not apply in many cases.
Yeah. So how do you get those, you know, those early adopters? You're there, right? Mm-hmm. You're as the entrepreneur, like I'm just kind of applying it to myself. You're there. You can feel the pulse of what's happened with the people. You got, you know, you're under 20 people. You're still in that stage where they still look at you like the rock star.
Yeah. Right?
You got all the focus, whatever the leader says goes, mm-hmm. we're going to do that. Now you start getting on and there's more leaders involved, right? Yeah. You start to separate. You can't, you know, get to 30 and 40 and 50 people and the organization changes. And look, I suffered. Right. It was mm-hmm. really tough for me to make those transitions.
Mm, right? I imagine.
You know, I tell a story a lot about a woman who I brought on as a business coach. And one day she comes in and just beautiful woman. She's a great business coach, red hair, comes in. She comes to my office one day and she locks the door. Uh-huh. And it was like my coaching day. She goes, "Today we're going to lock your door." I'm like, "Great, I'll get the focus. And, you know, people, you know, will come in." She goes, "Nope. We're going to lock you in." I go, "What? She goes, yeah. You've hired all these amazing people and you walk out and you keep stepping on all their air hoses."
Exactly.
and she's looking at me like, you know, you understand they're great people and you got to trust that. But, you know, there's a part of you who's look, I'd never done that. Right? Look, I had been leading a small band of warriors through battles, you know, my whole career. And that adjustment, because there's wins and losses with that, right? I suffer even today at the size that we are, I still suffer with that process and how to keep, you know, every time an accountant comes in and goes, "There's a financial issue." I'm like, "You see, I got to jump in," right? That there's a one inside of me that thinks that he can go solve every one of these. And let's talk about, so how do you get and keep people, the bigger you get, how do you get to the point where they maintain profitability and the motivation and the rock star enthusiasm, or even maybe it's different now. Maybe it goes from being a rock star leadership to what?
So the second stage, also using Rachel Turner's language here, is the considered architect, right? Which is really like a gigantic leap, I would say, if you come from this brave warrior. And she's also not saying that you need to let go of that other mode completely. It's more like, what can you switch on and off at what time when it's most appropriate, right? So I think to your point of like, well, I should jump in, I can do this better. That's a mindset a lot of founders have. You know, as founders, we're all very, very much overconfident and, you know, believing in our abilities. And yet it's not the right question to ask, can I do it better? You know, well, is my time better spent on this? That's the question that you should ask, right? And the truth is that in many businesses, it's, you know, the large majority of things you should be doing, I'm going to be very controversial now, Anthony, the large majority of things your business should be doing should be mediocre and no better. Right?
Wait, say that again, because I think that went over my head. Audience, I'm guessing. So go back. So say that.
The large majority of things your business do should be mediocre and no better. For example, your accounting system. Does it need to be the best accounting system in the world? Does it need to, have the greatest account ever developed? No. It should just hit the standard, right? Like 6 out of 10, or what is it, a C or a D in the American grading system, right? As long as it's a passing grade, that's all you need. Anything over that is most likely overinvestment that takes away from your key priorities and your key competences in the market. So when you ask yourself, can I do this better? You're still with that mindset of like, what is the best possible job we could do here? For the large majority of things in your business, that's not the right question. The question is, you know, can we get the job done with just good enough, with as little cost and little complication as possible? Now, I'm only saying that, Anthony, because there must be two or three things in your business where you absolutely want to kill it, right? And this is typically like your product, maybe your market positioning. Sometimes it's like doing something special for employees or being like an employer of choice. But very often it's just limited to those two or three things. Maybe it's your technology. Maybe it's like, you know, your dealer network, whatever your business is, right? But try to limit that to just two or three key competences that nobody else can match. All the rest should be good enough at as little possible cost. And so very often it's actually good to hire somebody who just can do the job, but is not perfect at it, at a lower cost than what you cost to the business.
That's right. No, no. Finding those folks that can do a reasonably good job. Right? Yeah. They may not be perfect, by the way, nor am I. Right. And that's sometimes your ego gets in the way and forgets that and just go. All right.
Are you saying founders have ego?
No. Come on. Well, that's the problem, right? Like your brain, your ego. And by the way, that's the thing that got you up in the morning to go do this. There was a little bit of that, that ego worked. And
absolutely.
Right. Without it, you probably would not have bold. You know, there was a gentleman this morning asking me about, he wants to go start a treatment center or a rehabilitation uh-huh. center. He's got a patch, he's in France, and then he's going to get redeveloped from a company. They're going to pay for him to go get redeveloped. And I said, look, that's a great idea. Look, just remember that, you know, being an entrepreneur, the idea of what you're doing and what you actually do on a given day, there's a little bit of different there.
And gigantic gap, I would call it.
Yeah,
like exactly. A Grand Canyon kind of gap, right?
Right. I mean, your thought of, you know, look, you're helping others, which is a wonderful idea. Look, he's a wonderful guy that wants to, you know, do help others in a place that doesn't have those kind of facilities mm-hmm. in Southern France. And he's like, we don't have these kind of things here. And you guys have it in the States and people really benefit from it. And people here, they kind of hide in the dark. And I get it. So he wants to bring it to light and bring mm-hmm. facilities that would be great for people to find a place to find recovery. And so great. And the next stage is he's going to have to go do it. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's where, you know, that takes a little bit of your ego. Your ego's going to step in there and you just got to get relentless about the work you're doing isn't helping people at first. You know, it's getting people, getting relationships, building, you know, finding places that you can refer people to you, you know, building those relationships. That's kind of not helping people yet.
Yeah, there are so many entrepreneurs who have a great idea for maybe like a technology. You know, just this morning in a Reddit startup thread, I was reading about somebody with the idea of like, what if there were an app that would, you know, send promotions from retail stores to whoever was within the nearest mile or something like that, right? And so technology, this is a very interesting idea, but of course it's been tried many times before, and time again, people will stumble upon realizing actually that needs a lot of partnerships and it's a chicken and egg problem because, you know, which retailer would want to invest time with you before you actually have the customers on the app and how do you get the customers? So, you know, it's a cold start problem in that sense, right? And so people start realizing just the idea is often nothing compared to thinking through the whole business model, thinking through your go-to-market, thinking through also the culture you need to set and the kind of people you need to hire. And of course, most founders are coming from like a, let's call it a technical or an expert or maybe a product background, something like that, which is great to get started. But over time, realize you're not really building a product. You're really building a business, which means you're building a sales machine. You're building a business model that generates cash over time.
Yeah, you're solving the, you know, the idea. I always thought, I love, you have the idea and then you expand the idea. But that space between the two of those is pretty damn chaotic, right? Mm-hmm. The you know, getting the mail picked up, getting the bills paid, getting the mm-hmm. You know, finding someone that knows how to program in that language, or finding someone mm-hmm. that can, you know, communicate, or someone that's going to call the, you know, that what you were just talking about. Someone's going to call the brands and say, hey, I'm going to build this. Build this
distribution, will you come? Right?
Right. Yeah. So all of those take a little bit of, and, you know, prioritizing what's important, you know, there's always this fine edge. I notice that when I build a business where I got to keep everybody on track enough to keep the revenue going mm-hmm. while we're looking at the big idea. So the big idea is out there and you're always looking at it, but you got to keep enough revenue to keep this team. Look, if we bankrupt out, that's it. We're out. So what? I have a great idea. I can't run out of cash.
Yeah, exactly. And this is probably one of the hardest skills for entrepreneurs to learn, which is, you know, how do you translate that big, compelling vision into something really small, but winnable that can actually keep the, you know, pay the bills, or at least, you know, if you're in an investable business, of course, it would be more like, how do you generate the market's results so that investors will come back for a next round?
That's right. Right. So they can see the progress and the big win at the backside of it. Look, people will invest in you. They'll make big investments in you. They just got to be able to see the backside of this thing being a big payoff. Now,
yeah,
let's talk a little bit.
The backside, of course, Anthony, but also, like, are you actually making real steps towards that? And so, you know, to take an example, everyone knows now Uber is gigantic and you know, is doing millions of rides every day, right? But they started off as just black cabs in San Francisco, right? And they may have had that very big vision from the outset, but that's not something you can execute on from day one. It's what is available, where can I close a partnership, and how can I start showing some initial traction, even if it's like, you know, 0.01% of what ultimately my total market is going to be.
That's right. And the stuff that happens, I remember when Uber opened here in Chicago, mm-hmm. right? The app wasn't developed yet. They were still giving people phones, right? We opened their first office here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. We did the work on it, and I was putting plug strips everywhere. Like, literally, I lined, there were 10, we were trying to plug in some 10,000 phones. Maybe it was 3,000 at a time. So we were trying to plug in to plug strips so they could get the phone set up, so they could give each one the new drivers. It was like a boiler room. It reminded me when I was a kid. I worked in one of those boiler rooms, and it wasn't organized yet. They hadn't figured out how to put the app on people's phone. They would give them a phone, and
That's a great example, because it shows, like, you're actually building a market or building an actual sales operation before all of your technology is ready. And in early stage, that's such a common problem, that founders are scared to go to the market before everything is ready. And those are the ones that never make it.
So let's keep going through this journey. So entrepreneur, rock star mentality, got the band, got the folks, the entourage around the rock star. We're going, now we start to get to mid stage.
Yeah. So assuming that with that band, they gotten to some degree of what we call product market fit, right? So what that means is, after lots of iterations, often for a year or more, they finally found something that sticks. There's a unique solution to a painful problem that at least some customers are willing to pay to solve. That's what I call product market fit. Now, what you have to do is to start expanding that. And I like to call that moving from product market fit to product market dominance. Because guess what? You've only proven it with a few people, maybe a few companies, whatever your business is. Now you have to kind of land that entire possible segment before competition does. And, you know, I'm in the world of, like, VC-funded startups typically. And so they're very proud, like, okay, we just raised our seed round or our Series A. They announce it everywhere. And then they're surprised there's suddenly tons of competition creeping up. Well, of course, you know, you found some product market fit. Now everyone sees it's for the taking. So how do you start basically conquering that market before someone else does? Or, as somebody in the Andreessen Horowitz VC called it, how do you figure out the distribution before the incumbent figures out your technology?
That's right. And that's the thing that you have to remember is that they're attacking you every day.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's where, you know, the team and everybody's got to remember, you know, now you've gone from the rockstar team. Now you've got new players coming on board, mm-hmm. but remembering that, look, our competition's chomping at our door, knocking at our door every single moment of every day. Mm-hmm. And if we don't push forward with, you know, great insight and great motivation, we're gonna get eaten up.
Exactly. And it can also be something like something defensible, like you may have a patent, you may have software that nobody else has developed, you may have some trade secrets, but none of these are really sustainable over time, because guess what? People move around. You know, some of the larger tech companies out there are still very much aggressive in pursuing new ideas, maybe buying the company, or if you don't agree to the acquisition, they'll just kill you, right? A big company out there has done that many times, and there's many other examples of that too. So I think it's really about, do you figure out not just the product, but also now really go in that race of conquering that market before someone else does? And all right, this, there's something that's playing around with all the AI startups in San Francisco right now. You know, there's tons and tons of greenfield there that they all try to occupy their place. But they're only just now starting to say, how can I build a market before the big guys jump in and take our market for us?
Well, or at least get far enough where the work you've done, and there's a lot of those guys right now that's
appreciated, and yeah, it might be better for them to acquire you, right?
Yeah, right. There's a lot of that going on. Like get far enough along where you get some value out of it.
Yeah.
So now you get this team, and you're moving forward. You're mid stage now. Yeah. You've got everybody working, knowing, hey, we got to develop this product. We got folks chasing our tail. Right, yeah. The competition's coming. They're getting a little closer. Right, we got to make some jumps, some leaps. Right, let's talk a little bit about, you know, how do you coach the founder? Like I had to go through, and the founder. How do you keep them, and how do you continue to grow them? What are the things you want them to learn? What are the ways you want them to be in mid stage?
Yeah, so a key thing that we prioritize is to put key thoughts on paper. So typically we work with the founder and the team, the leadership team, to draw up what we call a one-page strategic plan, right? And it's literally like the key meta decisions of the business, like which are we targeting? What is the key value that we provide? What are our long-term goals? Instead of them all being in the head of the founder and changing all the time, we say, can we just at least write them down and kind of settle on this? Doesn't mean they're set in stone forever. It's more like draw a line in the sand. Can we work with this for 3 months and then maybe revisit and see if we can set some new priorities? But just putting that out of the head of the founder onto paper helps a lot in now giving people a stable base to operate from, right? Turning that then into goals and objectives that every leader can actually work with on their team makes it possible to finally start doing things in parallel where the founder is not always the bottleneck. And that's really the goal here.
So let's talk a little bit about this. So in other words, you're saying these are the few ideas. Now, a handful, you're talking 4 or 5 ideas that are our principles. Look, we want to do this every day. We want to be the best at this. You know, for me, I'm just thinking related to the construction world that I'm in. Look, turning projects over on time.
Yeah.
Right. Our number one goal, turn projects over on time, period.
Yeah.
We don't turn them over on time. People can't count on us. It says something about who we are. That's like number one, right? Make them profitable, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Make them profitable. Mm-hmm. Now that's really big. And why do we put that in front of our people? Right? Our people are next, but we're not going to be here if we're not profitable. Yeah. Right? Our people won't have a job if we're not profitable. So turning over on time, being profitable, finding great people, you know, growing our people, right? That's a kind of a nebulous thing to say, but what does it mean to grow your people?
Mm-hmm. Right? And what kind of people do you want to work with and do you not want to work with, right? So there's not a single thing I think that can describe the whole strategy in just one or two phrases, because as you already point out, there's a few different ways of looking at a business, like what makes us successful financially. What is the kind of value we provide to customers? What are the kind of people we want to work with? So what we provide there in that one-page plan is essentially an empty structure that has all those key questions already listed. And typically when I just sit together with the founder, you know, they can fill out about 60-70% right from the outset just for us brainstorming together, right? And then, you know, some of the other things like how do we translate that into quarterly goals for the teams? There are typically recommend, let's do that in a workshop with the folks, not just top down.
Got it. So you bring them together, work in a workshop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit.
So, yeah, I mean, many people do like offsides and then it's focused on like building a raft together or all these like team building activities. And there's value in that. But I'm really convinced that the way a team really learns to work together is by actually doing the real work together. So we often take them for an offsite, you know, not far from the office even, but it's still an office situation or a meeting room where for a day, maybe 2 days, we have a highly energetic like get together around building that one page plan together. And it asks questions like, what are our strengths and weaknesses? Let's be open about it, right? It's about what are the trends in the industry, but also like, what's the kind of company we want to have maybe 10 years from now? How does that break down into the things we need to get done 3 years from now, 1 year from now, and a quarter from now? And who's responsible for what? And how do you define that responsibility? All those questions, that takes about a day or two, as you can imagine, to pull it all together. but you leave that workshop with full clarity, everyone energetic and happy to hit the ground running with their teams.
And it's not a hard one to do. Those little offsites don't have to be, you know, trips to Paris for the whole team. It could be literally rent a hotel, a conference room down the block from the office, and just get everybody out of the office, away from the phones, just in a focused environment where you can actually do and actually hear each other, not care. You know, oftentimes I feel like when we do it in the office, we drag our stuff at our desk into that conference room.
Yeah, that's why I really don't like doing them in the office, although I have to say it's changed a little bit since the pandemic, when now the office is the rare destination, right?
Mm-hmm. All right,
okay, that's a different topic.
Well, let's talk about that. Hold on. Are you seeing people come back to the office?
So here in San Francisco, it's probably the biggest laggard in the whole world about people not coming back into the office.
Really?
I see in many other cities, the 3 days a week kind of coming back to the office. I loved it when I was in London and I asked, are you going back to the office? And the guy says in his British accent, well, I'm a twat. I'm like, you're what? He's like, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. So I love to hear that. But, you know, so I think it's still very much hybrid is here to stay. Everyone's trying to figure out some rules or guidelines as to, like, how do we actually manage this? But I do think that, you know, it's still so important to have people to come together for intense working sessions. Right. And yeah, and you know, like I've had some of my best sessions in facilities that were not fancy at all. I had one on literally in a construction site in an open room where they had just finished the ceiling. You know this stuff better than I do, I'm sure. And we had a gigantic office space with one table in it and one whiteboard, and that was it. And I tell you, people did have room to hear each other.
Look, if the people that are here. You know, my judgment is that people are, you know, we're the most adaptable creative beings to ever exist, right? And when we stop and we work together, there's not much that a group of humans can't do. I mean, we've shown, you know, by the way, we've done some really stupid things, but we've also done some really great things. Right? Mm-hmm. As humans, when we come together around an idea, and we watch and we see each other and we let go of the baggage and stories and stuff, the angers or frustrations, and we truly work together to create some great ideas. It's so much fun to watch the creativity and what happens there. And, you know, look, I really love that you've been able to take these growth things and, you know, from the companies you've grown, right? What are those little secrets that we want to leave an entrepreneur with today? So if we were to say to them, hey, guys, these are a couple of things we want you to remember.
So from the top of my head, I think getting your thinking down on paper so that at least there's some high-level guidelines what the business is doing is absolutely crucial. And that's almost like the starting point to be able to start running things in parallel. I think second is, learning to be more open for feedback. That's not a strong suit for people in the brave warrior stage for good reason. But as you grow and as you have more people, everyone needs to learn. And so including the founder. And it is about, you know, being open for feedback, even setting a culture of feedback in your company that is really important, right? I think the other one is getting ever more data-driven, or some people call it scientific, in the sense that many companies default to, well, whoever is highest ranked gets to make the decision, right? And learning to be more, well, what's the data saying? Even if the most junior person in the room has better data, ultimately that opinion should prevail, right? And on top of that, I think in order to do that, you need to have a culture of learning to disagree, but commit, where knowing that not taking a decision is actually the most harmful thing you can do in most cases.
Most harmful. The waffling of a team, waffling of a group, people that sit in indecision, it tears things up, it burns the soul of the group, right? Even if you make the wrong decision, and I've made some wrong decisions as a leader, even if you make a wrong decision, you find out you made a wrong decision faster. Just get there, get it done with, move on to the next idea. And, you know, just stand in. It's okay to have those fall. It's okay to go through that. And the indecision is the killer.
Yeah, we learn from failure. And, you know, so that also means the decisions we take as a leader or an executive team, we also need to allow ourselves to fail every now and then. How else would we learn? On top of that, I would say an insight that came from Amazon, definitely one of the most successful companies out there, is that many decisions are what they call two-way door decisions. You can always turn them back, you know. There's very few decisions that are so costly to turn back that you really have to think them through carefully before you make them. But the large majority of decisions, you can just take it, try it, and if it doesn't work, then try something else, right?
Yeah, and Roland, as we continue to grow, now we can do that next really big stage of a company, right? You're 1,000 plus employees. Now, does a founder need to leave?
It's a good question, but I'm not a fan of that. So in Silicon Valley in particular, it used to be that when you raised your Series B, which at the time was probably like 20, 25 million, it means you're really proven as a business. That would almost come with the condition that somebody else would take over as CEO. Now, even the venture funds, who are not exactly known for their niceness, I would say, have stepped back from that because they've realized that, you know, keeping the founder in charge is actually of a high benefit to the company because they have a charisma and a way of getting things done that no outsider could ever aspire to, let alone manage, right? Mm-hmm. And there's too many stories of founders being replaced by an external CEO that really, you know, turned the company from bad to worse, often leading to a very quick acquisition at cents on the dollar, right?
That's right. That's right. So getting that, all right, the rock star isn't going to necessarily make all the decisions. We need to now pepper them in with, look, you can't go in hotel rooms and smash furniture and do all the rock star stuff you do. You can't, you know, it's time to, you know, grow up a little bit and you know,
this is the key, Anthony, sorry to interrupt you, but this is the key. That founder should stay in charge on the condition that they're learning and that they are open for learning. If they stick with who they are at the early stage and they insist on not changing, then they're going to get ousted no matter what.
Great, great advice. That's great, great conversation. Roland, I got to tell you, let's talk a little bit about the books you got out there. So you got some great books. I want to make sure the audience, look, you got to go check them out. The work that Roland does about growing companies, this is look, you want to find the stuff that will grow you. These are great books. They're easy reads. They're stuff that you can knock off and in a couple of weekends here. And it's a great way to learn. So
I'll show you the classic one, which is Scaling Silicon Valley Style. That's the one that's been out for a few years. But it's really our way of thinking, the model of like, how do you think of all the different phases of scaling your company? Including all the valleys of death and like the parts where you can get stuck and how do you get out of it?
The valley of death is the not willing to change, right? In there. What about the other books?
Yeah, other books. So there's a more specific one that we published during the pandemic, which was Leading Your Startup Through Crisis, which is more of a slide book. So it's an even easier read. You know, it has slides and descriptions, if you can see this on the camera. Yep. And it helps basically in a situation where you feel very much under threat or in a crisis, like how do you quickly rearrange about solving that crisis and getting out of it? That's why we decided not to use too many textual blocks and just give you slides. And then this one came out last year, Mid-Stage Momentum. That's interviews with like 50 odd founders of companies that are going to be the next unicorns right now. Where we, you know, redo the interviews around certain themes, like what are all the themes that you really need to focus on as a founder when you're in that stage?
Look, your wisdom, your experience going through these unicorn companies. Look, our audience is grateful to have you on here. It's been a pleasure to have you on. Audience, I'll put all the links to the books down below. Trust me, pick them up. Also, talk to us about what you're going through. I'll make sure Roland answers. We gets the questions. You know what you're going through right now. Talk to me about what you're going through, what you're struggling with. Where are you as a founder or working with a founder? You know, what are the struggles you're going through? Put that down below. Come on. Look, that's, we'd love the chat down there where we get feedback for each other. And that's what I'd love about this audience is that we get great feedback and great momentum in conversation. So, put that down below.
If I may ask Anthony to also put one more link down there, midstage.org/thrive. And that has also the links to all these books and other resources, but also in particular for people listening to this show, an ability to reach out and just talk through some of these problems with one of our coaches to see if there's something that, you know, they maybe we can resolve a blind spot for you.
Well, and Roland, if they want to get a hold of you, what's the best place for them to get a hold of you?
Yeah. So the best is just go to that page, midstage.org/thrive. It has all the contact data as well, whether it's LinkedIn or Instagram or just, you know, a phone call, whatever you're most comfortable with.
I'm grateful, man. Great podcast. You were easy to talk to. I got a lot out of it myself. I'm really thankful. Thanks for being on the podcast today.
Oh, it was such an honor. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. You've got an amazing podcast going, Anthony, and you're a great interviewer too.
Thanks, Roland. I'm grateful. Audience, as always, if you can take a second, like and subscribe, it means the world to me and the crew in the background, all the hard work they do to put these together for us. And I'm grateful. Thanks for being here today.